Welcome to episode 7 of the Information Nation, the official podcast of the Rhode Island Department of Environmental Management's Division of Fish and Wildlife. I am Dana Kopeck, your host for this month's episode, and also the editing manager of the podcast and the technical assistant for the Hunter Ed and Aquatic Resource Ed programs. With me today is Brandon Ellman, the production manager and range supervisor.
Hello, everyone.
In this episode, we will be talking to Hugh Markey. He is a teacher, journalist, and naturalist, and has participated in documenting many of the division's programs over the years. Welcome, Hugh.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Excellent. Thank you. Where are you from originally?
Well, I'm Rhode Island born, Rhode Island bred, and when I die, I'll be Rhode Island dead.
Excellent.
Good one. And what is your educational background?
Well, so I came about to this a little bit backwards in a way. So I've been, for the last 30 some odd years, I've been a high school English teacher. But I graduated from URI back in 1980 with a degree in journalism. And so bounced around a little bit, had different professions before entering the teaching profession. And I've been here teaching right now high school English in Pilgrim High School in Rhode Island and ever since.
Excellent. And how did you get into the many avenues of work that you do?
Well, I think probably the my start, you know, I've always written here and there a little bit and had a couple of things published here and there, but I kind of became more serious about it about 10 years ago. I had a colleague who it turns out was she had trained in ornithology. She was a science teacher at my high school. And she found out, basically we were chatting, she found out that I was interested in birds. And very shortly after, she said, you know, if you're interested, I'm gonna be working with my old professor, an ornithologist, and he's going to be tagging saw-whet owls if you wanna come along. And I thought, wow, that'd be great. So I went along and I brought a camera and I took a few notes and I ended up sending it off to my local newspaper and just simply said, you know, hey, if you have space for this, I thought it might be interesting. And they published it. And it wasn't, you know, pretty short after that I began to get more interested in it. I did another column about woodcock and got that published. And when they did, the editor wrote back and said, yeah, we're going to run this. And when it runs, we'll talk about setting up with a column. So from there, you know, it just kind of grew and grew, began to cultivate different connections and looking for different stories along the way until now, you know, it's 10 years down the road and I've done a fair amount of work, not least of which includes DEM as one of my best sources for new stories and new information.
And you kind of treat this as a secondary. You say you still teach, right?
Yes. I mean, my goal ultimately is to be able to get enough work to retire from teaching and do this freelance work full time.
Oh yeah, okay.
It's still a work in progress.
Yeah. Well, that's a common sentiment. Everyone has, you know, many different talents and often needs to put them to different uses to, you know, kind of pay the bills.
This is one of my side gigs for now. Yeah. That's it. There's that.
Yeah, saw-whet sounds fine. That's the one that I missed. I had the same experience as an ornithology student, but I never saw any that night. I've only done it the once. So there's another bird nerd. That's one that's gotten away from me so far.
Yeah. Well, owls are just incredibly special because they are so rarely seen, at least in my experience.
Yeah.
So to be able to work with an ornithologist who knew enough about how to call them in and we were using a mist net at the time, it was a great opportunity to see these cute little guys.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I've seen some of the bigger ones with those little saw-whets. Yep, only in literature and video.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
So what is a naturalist for those who may not be aware?
So in my particular case, I work in the summertime, I work for the Watch Hill Conservancy. And that is the group that is in charge of Napatree Point Conservation Area down in Westerly. And what they do, the area has been a conservation area for about 13 or 14 years now. And when that was I mean, it's obviously always been a beach. It's a beautiful area with two different bodies of water. Because it's a peninsula, you've got Little Narragansett Bay on one side and the Atlantic on the other. And this peninsula stretches out to the westernmost point in the state. And part of the Watch Hill Conservancy's charge as a conservancy is to make sure that you've got naturalists out there to do a lot of different things. We do everything from giving walks to, you know, free walks to visitors on the weekends. We run children's program where we take youngsters out and show them the area and teach them a little bit about the aquatic environment, to patrolling for things like, you know, dogs. We're not supposed to have dogs on the beach out there. But mostly arguably our most important job is conservation. There are a number of different species of rare and endangered birds that nest out there. So we help out Fish and Wildlife and U.S. Fish and Wildlife and DEM to keep track of these birds and make sure that, you know, do what we can to make sure that they're safe. Napa Tree is actually part of the Atlantic Flyway. So it is a stopping off point, whether it is just simply to stop and rest and feed on a larger migration, or it is to stop and rest and nest, as we have happened in the spring and summer, for things like the piping plover. So all those things are part of what we do. We support conservation programs, and we reach out to the general public and give tours of the area, all of that stuff. So it's a great job. I'll tell you, if I could do that full time around the all year round, I'd be happy to. I'll be more than happy to go out on, you know, in the middle of winter to do some work, because it's such a beautiful place.
Yeah, you're right. Napa Tree's great. Yeah, the oyster catchers and stuff that you see out there, it's a great spot for birding. And yeah, it's great that you're a part of that.
It's an amazing spot.
A lot of our staff, yeah, kind of does the same thing. I know some of our enforcement officers kind of have done double duty and volunteering their time down there to safeguard some of the nesting habitat. And I think Mary and such, she's touched on last week, was touching on flyaway stuff and their importance. And I would be surprised if she's been down there once or twice with outreach groups, because it's a great spot.
That's great. It's an important spot for education, because you were talking about that. We have folks from, at any given point, we've probably got about 10 different scientists working on research projects on Napa Tree. We have master's degree students and those that are doctoral candidates coming out and being able to access Napa Tree, because it is a pristine environment, which is, it's difficult to find.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of that that goes on that people aren't even necessarily aware of, that are kind of kept on the down low there, but it's really important for our understanding of various types of wildlife and geology and lots of different things.
Yes, that balancing act. You want people to see the natural environment. You want people to benefit from it, but you want to make sure the crowds are under control too. And like you said, dogs and such, like people, exactly. You know, the more people come out there, you know, friction between the natural world and humanity can sometimes be tricky. So
that's true.
You had mentioned that there are public tours. Is that something that is going on right now with COVID, or is it on hold?
We've continued the tours. We're socially distancing and masking up for these. What they are is, once after we get through with Memorial Day weekend, shortly after that, we begin weekly tours of Napa Tree. Every Saturday morning at 9 o'clock, we offer a free tour. Folks of all ages are welcome. The naturalists are there to take people out, and we really gear the walks to people's interest. So if we've got a lot of birders, we'll focus on that. If we just have folks that have never been to Napa Tree, we'll just talk about this. There is history, there is natural history, all kinds of different things. And we're very careful to make sure that we stay a good distance apart. Obviously we're outdoors, so that works in our favor. But we all wear masks, and we insist on visitors wearing masks as well. So, we did it last summer and it worked out great. And we're fully intent, as far as I know, to do it again this summer. So highly recommended. It's really nice. We get a lot of people that have, We have people from all over the world who come out, but we also have folks that say, you know what, I've lived in Rhode Island my whole life and I've never been here.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's a nice blend.
Yeah, there's plenty of spots in the state that I'm guilty of not seeing yet. So that's one I have, but only a few times. Because as a Rhode Islander, that's quite a drive. So it's like, going out from Kingstown, it's like, oh, that's 45 minutes.
Pack the oxygen and an extra lunch.
Right.
And what are some of the publications you have written for?
Well, I've written for the Providence Journal. I've written for, I'm in the midst of writing, getting together some stories for 41 North Magazine, which is, it's a publication of Rhode Island Sea Grant and the Coastal Institute at the University of Rhode Island. It is, so that magazine focuses on things like climate change and marine commerce and recreation, all revolving around coastal communities of Rhode Island. I also write for Momentum Magazine, which is a, it's a magazine also from the University of Rhode Island that focuses on different topics related to what's going on at the university. We have written about the way, you know, for example, different businesses have had to cope with the COVID virus. Sometimes I've written stories about a different folks, like a professor who recently completed a history professor who completed a publication on a history book that he had. So it's a variety of different topics that are URI based, but not necessarily exclusively of interest to that community. Publication goes out to different legislators and state officials and things like that. And what else? I've written for local papers, places like, written for different places around New England, but also things like the Charahoe Times, Rhode Island Central newspapers, Rhode Island Monthly Magazine, lots of different places. And usually just about always with a few exceptions, but almost always with some aspect of natural history as the focus.
Yeah, perusing, you have a blog, correct, that you kind of catalog some of those stories and perusing through there, plenty of, all have that kind of naturalist bent to them, but pretty far afield of different specific topics, ornithology to more of the Bay stuff.
Basically what I do, that's science and nature for a pie, which I'll tell you about in a second if you're interested in the background of that title. But that's my blog, which is sort of it's an ongoing portfolio of stories that have been published in different parts of the, they've appeared in different publications around New England. And the reason there's such a kind of an odd variety is because I, as a freelancer, in many cases, I choose my own topics. So for example, if I hear about something going on with DEM, for example, about the artificial reef that you folks participated in installing off Sabin Point in Providence. Sometimes I just get wind of something like that going on and I'll just call up and say, hey, I've heard about this. What can you tell me about it? And in other cases like Rhode Island Monthly or the Providence Journal, they may assign, put out an assignment for me and I'll pick it up from there.
Okay.
So it's in probably 9 times out of 10, it is natural history related. And then the others are just things that are there to pay the rent.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I was actually going to ask exactly that, stories, like how you come to different subjects, but that kind of answers that. Yeah, kind of as the seasonal things kind of come in and out, see an interesting lead and you take it,
Yeah, I mean, I'm lucky enough so that I've reached the point where a number of editors know me and know who I am.
Oh, yeah,
network,
so
they
sure.
will sometimes send me off something saying, hey, this is, we'd like to do this type of thing for the next issue. Why don't you take a look around? And like I said, other times it's just something that pops into my head or based on that experience that I had, I might decide to pitch it to an editor to see whether that person might be interested in such a story.
Yeah.
So keeps it really interesting.
Yeah, it sounds like
I love learning new things.
Is there anything in the, the recent past that you haven't been able to, that you saw but weren't able to do, or something that you're looking forward, like trying to get a connection with that you haven't yet been able to kind of get in person with?
I had I had one that had been sort of sitting in the virtual drawer for a couple of years, and I couldn't find a home for it. I had this idea about writing about mountain lions.
Oh, yes.
The presence or absence of them here in Rhode Island.
Yep. We were talking about that a couple weeks ago.
I couldn't seem to. Yeah. So I really couldn't quite find the publication for it. I tried a couple of places and I thought, well, okay, you know, I got turned down. And I thought, but this is, I really liked it. You know, if I do say so myself, I thought it was a great topic.
Yeah. It's a very nebulous topic. And like people love the conjecture around it. So.
Oh, it's like doing a story about Bigfoot, you know.
Yeah, so yeah, very much so.
You know, I still wanted to hang on to it, and then finally, I applied to the Providence Journal for it, and they ended up running this story. Your very own Charlie Brown, who is
I may have seen this exact one
source
again a couple weeks ago. Yeah, I was looking around to see where it was.
Yeah, Charlie Brown has been an incredible resource for me for different stories. And I contacted him. I'll tell you a little background of this story, and you can decide whether you want to hang on to the story or not. But I had been out birding in the Great Swamp and Management area. And, you know, I there was another couple that was coming toward me as I was going deeper into the area. And, you know, they had binoculars on, so birders usually will chat for a while and exchange notes and information. And it was a couple, male and female, and they seemed nice enough. And we chatted for a minute, and I said, well, you know, this was probably in, say, March or April. And I sort of started to conclude by saying, well, you know, it'll be great because the migratory birds will be arriving soon and things will really start opening up. And the husband said, well, yeah, that and the mountain lions. Yeah. And that was like a long pause. And I said, excuse me? And he said, oh, yeah. Yeah, there are mountain lions out here. We see them. We've seen them. And, you know, we see their footprints and stuff. Seen them quite regularly. And I just like waited another minute or two. And I thought, okay, well, great. Thanks very much, and I'll talk to you. I said to them at the time, I was like, so you're sure about this?
I know, they speak, mean, a lot of people speak like with such conviction.
Oh my goodness. It is. So that was the impetus for that story. And I got in touch with Charlie Brown. Charlie was nice enough to put me in touch with other biologists for in other states. There's Connecticut and Maine. I spoke to them about it. Did a lot of research, ended up finding photos. I was able to get photos of the last mountain lion shot in Rhode Island back in 1864.
Yeah.
That still exists. It's tucked away in a museum in the basement of a museum at Harvard. But it was just great. I mean, it finally ran into the Projo. And of course I had people adamantly denying the idea that these things were extinct and had been extirpated from the area.
Yeah.
I've seen them. I've got footage. I've got, you know, this, that, and the other thing. And
I'll send them to Charlie.
It was a lot of fun.
He hasn't seen anything that conclusive yet. So
he was excellent, you know, and, you know, he made the point, and rightly so, that everybody has a camera now.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely saw this exact story because I remember that line. Yeah,
right,
exactly.
Yep, and there's a cell phone. And now, you know, increasingly, trail cameras have become more and more affordable. I just got one myself quite recently.
Yeah, let's do
it.
So
with all that, and people walking all over the state, and everybody having their cameras in their pockets, we don't have a single convincing photo of one in Rhode Island.
Yeah.
And, you know, the pictures that run are often from, you know, you find out, you do a little digging, and you find out that it's actually from, you know, Canada somewhere, or you find out it's from Oregon or something like that. But nothing yet.
You're fact checking it. Yep.
That was a lot of fun to do.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Yeah.
He was great. So that was a long story about just this story that was a favorite of mine that I'm really glad finally I was able to get it out there.
Yeah. So you've mentioned, you know, working with the division occasionally, and So just in general, like, what are some of those programs you've documented and what standouts that, I mean, you just touched on one a little bit, but I think I've seen, you know, photos of you in the mm-hmm. goose banding stories and stuff like that. Any standout division programs that you've documented and have any experiences to share?
So I always like to, my favorite stuff, and the reason I keep coming back to doing more freelance work is when I can get out in the field with people to do things, whatever it might be, because it's just so incredible and so much fun. You know, one of the things I love about being a freelancer is I can actually call up somebody. If I hear something that they're doing something cool, like goose banding, I can just call somebody up and say, hey, you know, I'm a freelance writer. I'd like to do a story about it. And, you know, if it were just somebody cold calling up the street, the person would be like, no, of course not. I can't do
this. Talk to media. Yeah.
But because I'm going to be writing a story. Yeah. You know, I've had a chance to go out and do things, sometimes handle things. And that's been amazing. So a while back, I did speak to, you mentioned the goose banding. I talked to J.O. Sinkowski and got in touch with him because I had seen that you were looking for volunteers to go out banding Canada geese. And I ended up going out there, went out to Tiverton to one of the small ponds and participated in this goose roundup, which was just a blast.
It's interesting, isn't it?
I've actually forgotten that.
Before this, I was a seasonal for many years, so I've played around with that project plenty. So how hands-on did you get? Were you just kind of on the sidelines, or did you get?
Oh, any? I got in there, and it was really, really excellent. They had set up I know that you know about it, but your listeners may not know. They set up a sort of movable corral, and that was set up at the edge of, like, it was this path of tall reeds where they had set it up, and they had a number of volunteers and seasonals on kayaks that were going out to, the geese were in their molt, so they weren't able to fly. So they went to get them out on kayaks and began to sort of herd them, just like a slow motion quiet rodeo or something, herding the geese toward this corral. And as they finally got up there, there was this huge surge of about 60 Canada geese all rushing into this corral at once.
Wow.
Which is a fascinating experience, because it makes these kind of odd noises, and there's like this surge of living animals coming up toward you and so forth. And they began to sex the birds and band them and, you know, determine ages and the rest of the business that they were doing. And of course, those that had been trained were just whipping them out one by one, like nobody's business. They were going so quickly and stuff.
You can tell who's done it before.
And finally, after they, absolutely. You know, they were like zip, zip. And of course, you know, I know this is obvious to everyone, but they've got these long necks, and they were just very expertly tucking the necks under them, and they'd sit down with the goose's head underneath them, not sitting on the goose, of course, but just sitting in such a way that the goose's neck was out of the way, and taking care of the business that they had to, and then just moving on to the next one. They did 60 birds in a few hours while I was there. So I finally, you know, when I got to the point where they had done the majority of the birds, they offered to let me in there. I told them I'd like to be able to try it. And I thought, you know, I'm not afraid of these things. You know, it's, how hard can it be to just grab these things, tuck them around? I'd been watching the whole time, tuck them around and do what needed to be done. Well, apparently it is difficult to do, because the goose was not as cooperative as I would have liked. So
they're amazingly strong.
Kind of embarrassing. You put hands on them. They're really strong. Yeah. Yes. And you don't want to hurt them, of course.
No.
You don't want to put them in a headlock or something. But so I've got these enormous wings that are flapping around, smacking me in the face. And one of the techs had to come over and sort of quiet things down for a moment and, you know, reinforce how exactly I was supposed to do it. And we finally got it done. But I discovered that I wasn't thinking about the fact that they have, of course, they have these webbed feet, not a surprise. But at the tips of those webbed feet, they have claws.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, boy.
And while this one was trying frantically to get away from me, he gave me a really long scratch on my forearm that ended up drawing blood.
Yeah, the scratching feet and the little beaks, they have to like nip you in the legs with their those long necks.
Yes, I saw a number of people. I didn't get caught with that.
Yeah.
I didn't get caught with that, fortunately for me, but I did see it happen. And yes, exactly. They're sassy. It didn't look fun at all. So I was trying to be cool about it, you know, because I'd already been embarrassed by that goose doing his thing. And they finished it off and it all turned out well. But then I had to kind of like quietly go back to my car to get some paper towels and stuff to dab on my wounds, you know, the red badge of courage that I had. So, but it was great. I have to say it was the whole, I love when I can handle something or be right there up close and seeing something unusual like that. That was just a blast. I've also been out with Charlie Brown doing bat surveys.
Yeah, also very cool.
I did a couple of stories about that for on two different locations, and that too was just fascinating. You know, we went out to a particular location, actually not too far from where I live here in Richmond, and got out there before sunset, and he set up. There were two times that I was with him when we did it. One was where he set up microphones, special microphones with recording information.
Yes, yeah.
And I was able to go out there and do a bat exit survey as they were at a certain, you know, certain time. There was this kind of a utility garage that we were where we were stationed. And as they came out, we were in different spots and we were going to count the number of bats that came out. And Charlie and the rest of the folks were out there recording, using special equipment to record noises that they were making that we couldn't hear at the time.
Yeah, I believe it spits out like a spectrogram and they can then find the frequencies that are being, the calls are at and say, this is the X species or Y species.
Yes, yeah, and that was, in and of itself, I mean, just to be able to hear them, which we couldn't normally do, was awesome. And then just the fact that this was able to identify the species was just blew me away. So we had a great time doing that. And then at some point, fairly close to that period of time, we were at the Great Swamp, and Charlie was doing mist netting, and we were out there and I got a chance to see them close up. Unfortunately, of course, I could not handle them because I hadn't gone. It would have broken the protocol as far as getting the, you know, the rabies shots.
Yeah, the pre-vaccination sort of.
But I was able to, yeah. But it was still great to just be able to, you know, go out there. And we caught a nice number of bats that night. I was able to see them getting banded and all the rest of the business that went along with it was just fantastic anyway. So, you know, there's been a number of things that I've been able to go out. I've been really, like I said earlier, the EM has been a terrific source of information and stories, you know, to just be able to go out there whenever, periodically, I just will contact somebody from DEM and just say, hey, what are you guys up to? Because I know that you've pretty much always got something important coming up.
Yeah, new projects could be kind of cycling in. You never know.
Yeah, you know, I was there when you guys put up the artificial reef off Sabin Point. I watched the cranes depositing those structures, for want of a better word. I don't even know what you'd call them. They were the raw bones, really, of an artificial reef, which apparently now is just functioning quite well. I guess it's attracted a good amount of first the microscopic life and then, you know, larger seaweed, and then eventually fish have come along. I understand that's in use. It was great. You know, I was able to talk to fisheries specialist Pat Barrett about it, and he explained some of what had gone into selecting that location. That's the Nature Conservancy was working with you. I know that that DM works with the Nature Conservancy on a regular basis.
Yep.
And you had gotten together with them to deposit these things. It was also Rhode Island Saltwater Anglers Association had worked with you also in choosing that and helping to fund it and so forth. So it was great. It was just fascinating. So I feel like it's one of the things that I have kind of in the background, the back of my mind, whenever I'm writing, is that there's so much good, solid conservation work and research that gets done in Rhode Island. You know, people always think, well, California or Florida or, you know, some of the really large states are doing all the, they must be doing all the research and all the cool stuff related to that. And a lot of people don't know that this sort of work is being done right in their backyard, literally right in their backyard.
Yep.
And I kind of feel like that's, you know, and I feel like that's part of what, I mean, it sounds a little hokey to say my mission, but it's kind of my thing to just to let people know, hey, you know, there's a lot of good things going on right under your noses. And I'm lucky enough to go out there and watch it and talk to people who know about these things. But there's a lot that is really substantial that DEM does that are vital for Rhode Island's natural resources. So, you know, it's just incredible. So that's what I try to point out too, this, you know, whether I'm doing something from folks from URI or from U.S. Fish and Wildlife or DEM, there's good stuff going on here all the time.
Yeah, I was actually going to touch on that exactly that in that fashion, like just kind of thanking you for spreading the word, like for the programs like this and your stories. Like, we do want people to know what's going on in the state, get involved and stay interested, because ultimately that's what keeps, you know, funding and public sentiment on our side. We want to, you know, show off the nice things that we're trying to safeguard.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that just get overlooked because, you know, for whatever reason, sometimes the organization doesn't have time to really publicize their work, or sometimes the local news sources may not have the personnel to go out and either film or write about these things. And that's, you know, that's inevitable, but I think that's also really unfortunate. I think as news organizations have shrunk because of competition, they pulled off a lot of folks that used to specialize in environmental or conservation beat, you know, and because of that, a lot of that just gets dropped by the wayside. So I try to kind of keep an eye on that sort of thing and just keep reminding people that, gosh, we have so many amazing things going on in the state at any given point. There are things, even on a, you know, as of this taping, you know, this recording, this is February and it's cold and you know, damp out there and stuff, but there are still people doing things.
Oh yeah. Our waterfowl biologist is out banding ducks every morning, I think. So.
Well, this is what I mean. Banding ducks, or they're surveying for bears. I just did another story where Charlie was actually nice enough to be one of my sources that related to feeding bird seeds. Feeding the birds seed and the possible effect you might have, the side effect of attracting bears.
Yes.
So that was another one that just ran in the Providence Journal recently. And, you know, those things are going on because the reason he was able to speak to it is because of the work that DEM does, going out and you spent quite a long time. I also wrote about the survey that you had going a few years ago, where one of your folks was setting up I hesitate to call it a bear trap because that sounds violent, and it wasn't. You put out these bait stations, a certain method that you had of being able to get a little bit of hair sample.
Right. Yeah, I was going to say
bears
the hair trap
might be attracted to these things. That's it. Yeah. That's it.
Yeah, yeah. They just kind of nudge against it and leave a little telltale.
Yeah. Exactly. So because of that individual was in the middle of the woods, in the middle of nowhere, setting these things up. So nobody really knew about it.
Yeah.
And I was lucky enough to be able to go along and work with her and not work with her, but just go along while she was working and see what she was up to. And then again, some years later, when it came time to talk about the issue of bears haunting backyard feeding stations, bird feeding stations, Charlie referenced some of that information. So it's, you know, it's good work that DEM is doing. Yeah, that really provides the basis of knowledge that people get to just even, you know, be able to talk to the average person and give them the information that they can use.
Yeah, you touched on it. There's a between our, you know, kind of year over year, just general monitoring and then new projects coming in and out. And then again, URI, there's, you know, grad students of all sorts doing all kinds of projects, doing new research, you know, small stuff and big stuff. So there's always something going on.
And that too is a great resource for the students. You know, the fact that they can go out there and get some experience, get something on the resume with the help of DEM is a tremendous opportunity for them.
So kind of moving on, actually, I don't know, over the last year or so, have you seen, how have people been dealing with the pandemic in terms of like field work and stuff? Have you had less opportunities, or have you just been seeing them adapt? I know it is kind of nice being in the field. You're often outdoors and you can keep distance. So have you seen any of the impacts of the pandemic on the work that you usually cover?
I won't say it's been a tremendous effect, but it definitely has put a damper on things. there are more times when sometimes it's actually dictated by the university or the publication that I'm writing for, that they say just do the interview by phone.
Yeah.
And so I've definitely done more interviews. That was usually the court of last resort for me. I don't usually like to interview people by phone or by Zoom or whatever.
Apologies, but then.
Not at all.
Mostly joking, but yeah, you're right. That, in person, you know, is always preferable.
People are uncomfortable. So if I can get a story that can be done by phone, then I'm going to have to do it.
Yeah.
Whereas before, that wasn't even a question. Normally, if I'm writing, I like to visit the person, especially in their environment. That's a really important part of, you know, first preference is to go into the field with them while they're doing whatever the task is. But the second preference would actually go and visit them at their place of work and at least sort of see what their lair is like, you know, because I think you can get some extra color for your story by going and at least seeing them in person, even if they're not actually doing what you're writing about. And those opportunities are pretty much drying up.
That's about it.
But there are still other cases. I was lucky enough to go with a group that was going out banding sharks last summer. Everybody masked up, of course, but I was able to get out and do something there. That was needless to say, that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I saw that. And I remember that actually. I remember that professor, in fact. So, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that was Mako's, right? Again, so, I saw that on your blog.
Yeah. Yeah, that was unbelievable. I also, I'll be honest with you, I sometimes will deliberately use my writing skills to be able to wheedle my way onto situations that just sound really cool.
Oh, yeah. I don't think anyone will hold that against
you. Who wouldn't want to go out in a boat?
You're doing it for a good
definitely
cause. You're spreading the word,
so
we're all getting something out of it.
That's what I keep telling myself.
Yep.
The fact that I'm having a blast doing it.
I'll back you up on that.
That's secondary. Yep. But yeah, there you go. I appreciate that. So yeah, it's there's been a little bit of a damper put on things. I have another story coming up that I have to leave it up to the individual as to whether they feel, I really want to get to this person has a sort of workshop where they MacGyver different research objects, these different technical tools that they use in the field. And I would love to be able to go and visit him in his workshop while he's fiddling with these things. But I have to kind of leave that open to see what his comfort level is in doing that. So, I mean, this is going to end, you know.
Yeah, ideally. Yeah.
I have no doubt. So you just have to kind of do the best you can.
Yeah. We're all learning different ways of carrying out our work that, you know, some of it we won't be able to carry forward.
Yeah, exactly.
But we do want to get back to the old ways.
I always just pitch it that, you know, we can do whatever you're comfortable with. I respect people's concerns and that's fine. We can still get the job done. And then, you know, you just do the best you can until the time comes where you can all get back out in the field and not have to worry about such things, which will come.
Yep.
The outdoors will still be there.
Okay. So every episode we take a question from our listeners. And for this episode, the question is, what advice would you give to somebody who may want to become an environmental or natural history focused journalist or blogger?
Well, I would say the first thing I would do is be willing to write for free initially. When I had that story I was referencing before, when I had that story about the Saweet owls published, I did it just purely what we used to call tossing it over the transom, where I didn't even bother to query the editor at the time. I just simply said, I went on the adventure, I took pictures, I took notes, I wrote the story, and then I threw the whole thing over to, it happened to be the Charahoe Times, Rhode Island Central newspapers. And I said, here, you know, I hope you can use this if there's room. So I deliberately chose a somewhat smaller publication, and I didn't bother to mention anything about getting paid for it. Taking pictures was just my way of trying to make their job easier and make it more likely for them to publish the work, which is another thing you want to think about doing. If you can, the easier you can make an editor's life, the more likely it is that you're going to get published. So I think that would probably be, you know, my first thing, get some clips under your belt that you can reference, even if it's, you know, whether you're writing for free or whether you're writing for a free publication, like you're doing something online. Start small and just keep plugging. Find your passion. Start writing some stories about whatever aspect it could be. It can be something in politics. It can be something in natural resources or whatever. But start writing. And, you know, it's a cliche to say it, but a writer writes. So start doing that. Start sending it along. And if you get rejected, maybe the next question you need to ask them is, okay, so if that wasn't of interest to you, what else would you like? What are your needs?
Okay, well, that's some sound advice. And I also have a follow-up question. You had mentioned you have a blog. It's called Science and Nature for a Pie. And I don't believe we've touched upon that yet, but what does the title mean?
Oh, yes, we missed that. What was that?
So this is probably something that most people aren't even going to remember. Back in the 80s, there was a very popular game. It was hugely popular. Called Trivial Pursuit. Are you guys familiar with that?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Okay. All right. Essentially, Trivial Pursuit was this game. It was enormously popular, where you would take your game piece and you'd move around the board, and there were different, you'd get questioned on different topics. And one would be like, you'd land on one, a brown space might be arts and literature, and a pink space might be geography. If you think maybe almost like in terms of Jeopardy would be, you know, with that mixture of topics.
Yep.
And one of the categories was science and nature. And the game piece itself was a circular piece with little wedges that you would get. You'd earn it as you answered the questions correctly. And we used to refer to that as a pie.
It looked like a pie. Yeah. Okay.
So when you get to the end of it, you know, it'd be like science and nature for a pie, please. And you'd get that. And if you get your, you know, if you get the answer correct, you might be able to win the whole game.
Oh, so clever.
That is
I love
something that.
That
nobody knows about. Yeah. Well, I was looking for something that would kind of cover both. So, you know, because it wasn't going to be a heavy duty technical science blog. And nor was it going to be something that was, you know, I mean, it was just my choice that I didn't necessarily want it to be just a personal experience blog. I want it to be about things that people would relate to and be interested in. That's how I came up with the title. And I get questions sometimes, like a professor will say, you mean like science and nature for a pie, like PI? No, because math has nothing to do with my life. And that's all I know about pie, basically. I know it goes on and on. I don't really understand it. I'm a writer. I'm not a mathematician, so that's not it.
I don't relate there.
It's the much dorkier one that has to do with playing board games with the family. That's where it came from.
There you go.
Excellent. And we always love to include an unusual or comical story from our guests that they have encountered in the field. Hugh, do you have one to share?
Well, this wasn't necessarily, I have to say, I have one. It's not necessarily one that was related to DEM. But a while back, a couple of years ago, I was out at Chaffee Wildlife Refuge with Tim Mooney from the Nature Conservancy and Ben Gaspar from U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and they were dredging part of Narrow River. And this was on a winter's day. It was probably a lot like today is where we are right now. It's kind of probably about 30 degrees and windy. And there's this boat that was in Narrow River. And what they were doing is it was essentially sucking up the sand and detritus from the bottom up to carve out the channel. And then that was being deposited in along the shore. And so it was going to function in two ways at the same time. It was going to make the channel a little bit wider, and it was also going to sort of build up and reinforce the shoreline. So I went out there and took pictures and talked to Tim and Ben, and we were just toward the end of wrapping up. And I thought, oh, let's do an artsy kind of shot of this, this pipe that was coming in depositing the sand along the shoreline. So I'll get an interesting angle. So I walked up very close to the pipe, and I thought it was firm sand, because to look at it, you could just see sand. So I thought, okay, just be along the shoreline. So I walked up to take my picture, and I immediately sank down my knee, because what I was actually stepping in was simply sand that had been sort of blown up, if you will, by the water. So it looked like it was a solid surface, was not. So I was trying to play cool, because the guys had already started walking back to the car. And like, guys, kind of need a hand here. So they came back and pulled me out. And I mean, like, forcefully. It was like quicksand.
Yeah, it's a suction effect.
Lost my boot. Yes, so I left my boot in there, and fortunately Ben was nice enough and brave enough to go and reach down and get all wet and pulled my boot out of the water. And so that kind of cut my self-esteem down a couple of notches, but I had to empty out the boot, and it's all mud and cold water. And my foot was all, of course, ice cold. My pants were all a mess. I came directly from work, so I was wearing dress pants at the time. Oh, excellent. I was wearing wellies on my feet, but yeah, it was great, you know? So I ended up having those dry cleaned, and it was just not cool. It wasn't good for the ego. Definitely did not look like a pro at that.
Reality's a field work. That's
these things happen. I'm really glad that they were nearby, that they hadn't taken off. You know, I could have easily just simply said to them, okay, I'm just going to get a few pictures, you guys leave. And then it could have been like really seriously embarrassing.
Oh my goodness.
So I'm grateful for that anyway. Yeah. So self-esteem was dinged a little bit, but I got a story out of it anyway.
And Hugh, do you have anything else you want to add to the podcast before we wrap up?
Well, I think I wish you guys good luck with this. I know that, I think podcasts are definitely growing like crazy all around the world, really. So I definitely wish you guys the best of luck with the podcast and getting the word out about the great work that you all do and DEM.
Thank you.
I look forward to hearing more, and even the episodes that don't feature me, as you know, they might be a little disappointing, but I'm still looking forward to seeing what else you guys get up to.
All right. Yours is the gold star episode.
All right. See, I set the bar. That's how I roll.
Well, thank you, Hugh, for coming on today and speaking with us. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much,
Hugh. My pleasure. Very happy to do it.
Delightful chat.
Great talking to you both.
You as well. For next month's episode, we will be interviewing Corey Pelletier, who is one of our freshwater fish biologists. If you have any questions for him or any of our staff, please email Scott, S-C-O-T-T, dot Travers, T-R-A-V-E-R-S, at dem.ri.gov. That wraps up our episode. A big thank you to Hugh for coming on and sharing his stories. If you would like to reference more of his written content, his blog address is scienceandnatureforapie.com. You can find our podcast on all of the major podcast platforms, including Apple iTunes, Amazon Music, Spotify, and Podomatic, as well as the Rhode Island Division of Fish and Wildlife social media on Facebook and Instagram. Thank you, and see you next month.